We find ourselves a couple of days before the Coventry Theatre debut of Boy Out the City. The show had a sellout run at the Edinburgh Fringe and a short run in the West End, and it now comes home to Coventry for the first time. The autobiographical show is written and performed by Declan Bennett, my guest today, a Coventry lad, a Belgrade Youth Theatre alumni, part of the pop group Point Break, and also played Charlie Cotton on EastEnders. Declan, welcome to the Cov Pod, and wow, you've been busy.
Mate, thank you. It's very nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
No, my pleasure. It was really good. The Belgrade reached out to me and said, right, we've got something that we think you'd be really interested in. And I was like, this is bang on the kind of interview that I like to have. People that are from the city that have gone on to do amazing things and then want to come back to our city. So perhaps that's a good place to start. Give us an overview of what Boy Out the City is.
So Boy Out the City is it's the first play I've ever written. Anybody that sort of is familiar with the work that I've done before and that beautiful introduction you just gave me there is so basically Boy Out the City is the first play that I've ever written, and if anybody's familiar with my work, you'll know that, well, yes, like you said, that lovely introduction, I've done the boy band thing and I did the EastEnders thing, and then I sort of solidified myself in theatre and acting and music, and I don't know. I'm one of those people that I get restless very easily. So creatively, I like to sort of keep myself on my toes and keep challenging myself. And I guess like many of us during the pandemic, you know, we were faced with such time alone that maybe, you know, we started baking bread and maybe we started drinking a little bit earlier than we should have done. And I wrote a play. But I didn't really mean to write a play. Basically, the backstory of Boy Out the City is me and my boyfriend decided to leave London just before the second lockdown. And in a very strange turn of events, we're both city boys. You know, I grew up in Cov, he grew up just outside Belfast. So, and we've lived in London, you know, for the majority of our lives. So we just thought, you know what, the entire industry is shut down. Let's go live in the countryside for a bit. Like, if ever there was a time to just try it, now is the time. So we did. We rented a little cottage at the bottom of the Chiltern Hills. We'd only been there for about 3 weeks, being very smug. And he got a job in Atlanta. And so he moved to America for 6 months. And I was left on my own. And we went back into a lockdown. And I did the only thing that I knew how to do. And I just journaled the entire process. And I spent 6 months writing every single day about my thoughts, my feelings, and what was going on. And lo and behold, I got a play out of it. So I'm chuffed with this.
Do you know, this podcast, it always ends up somehow me talking about myself. I have all these amazing guests on and then I end up talking about myself. But my version of that is, I haven't got any here, but I started writing children's books during the lockdown. It was my
career. Oh, cool.
I wrote children's books about Coventry, the first one at that time about Lady Godiva. And it was almost for me a project to distract myself from everything else that was going on. And I always look back on that book and go, I didn't realize how much I almost needed that at that time as something for me to focus on every single day. And I'd get illustrations come through from my illustrator and things would move forward. I guess you're echoing that yourself.
Yeah, definitely. How long have you been doing children's books? Were you writing them before the pandemic?
No, so just starting in the pandemic. So I've got a history of celebrating. I'm trying to see if I can see anything up here to show you, but I've got a history of releasing merchandise. This is about you, not me, and I'll talk about myself all day. So, like, but it started in lockdown, and no doubt when you're at the Belgrade weekend, you'll see my books are on sale and stuff there. And it just was,
cool.
I guess it's really similar to how you're kind of reflecting your experience in the city. That's what my books have done. We've released 10 books since then, all about commentary. I'm talking about myself here. This is about you. I told you, I'm talking about myself.
It's all good. It's just, yeah. You know, it's lovely to just sort of touch base and chat with a fellow Coventry.
Yeah, go on then. So, Keek, so you, at that time, then you journaled. How did the journal inside and you reflecting turn into the play itself?
So, essentially, my other half being away for those 6 months, that was from October 2020 until March of 2021. And in March of 2021, I turned 40. In turning 40 is quite a big deal. It's like a bit of a milestone. And my other half came home about 2 weeks after that. But so I journaled all through the end of the year or from Christmas or from New Year, you know, when things opened up a little bit and then it all went crashing back down and everyone had a miserable Christmas and all those things. And I just kept thinking it back. I was like, God, I'm going to turn 40 in March. That's mental. And it was the last week before lockdown lifted. So I was one of them unfortunate people that have two birthdays in the lockdown. And the second one being my 40th. So I always knew in my head that I was going to stop journaling on my 40th birthday. That's going to be the last day. And then when I got to the end of that and I woke up the day after my birthday, that's when I really sat and I sort of collated all this material. And I reached out to a really good mate of mine, Nancy Sullivan, who's ended up directing the piece and being my co-creator. And I just sort of shared a lot of this work with her. And I just said, hey, Nancy, I think I've got something here. I don't really know. I don't know what it is. Is it a book? Is it something else? Is it a podcast? I don't know. I don't know what it is. But I sort of trust her instincts and trust her intuition. And we sat and we pulled it all apart. And we just realized that we had the bones and the beginnings of a really powerful and emotional and incredibly funny piece of theatre that was going to be very autobiographical and very honest, but incredibly universal in its content.
So obviously we mentioned that it comes to Coventry this weekend being and is it the 25th to the 28th, isn't it? I think I've got
15, yeah, Monday the 25th to Thursday the 28th, yeah.
Yeah, so then, but it has been performed elsewhere at the Fringe, at the West End. When did that first start then? Because obviously we've had that kind of time between lockdown and now. What's it look like between then and now?
Yeah, so, well, basically me and Nancy spent about the next sort of 12 months, so that would have been what, like going into sort of 2022 and figuring out what it was. We did a couple of scratch nights, which are the sort of theatre nights where new writers and new writing can be performed in front of very generous, kind audiences. And, you know, you can make mistakes and you can muck up and then you take the feedback away and you continue working on it. So we spent about 12 to 18 months in and outside of sort of doing other little jobs and other little gigs. And then we got a producer on board, and then the producer was like, at the beginning of 2023, just sort of dropped the bomb and just, not the bomb, but dropped the idea of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. And anyone that's ever been to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival knows anything about it. It's such an amazing, like, melting pot of new work and new artists, but then also very established professional creators as well. And I performed at the Edinburgh Festival when I was 16 years old with the National Youth Music Theatre. So I remember it, but that was like 25 years ago and I had a chaperone. So I was like, okay, let's go back to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival as an adult. And, you know, I can just sort of do whatever I want. And that's sort of how it happened, really. And then we took it to the festival. It was received really well. And then sort of just before we went up to the festival, we got this phone call to say we were going to do this really special one-off small short run in the West End, which just blew my mind completely, because I've done a bunch of shows in the West End and on Broadway, and to walk down Shaftesbury Avenue and see the poster in massive, massive lights outside the Lyric Theatre, and not even just me being on the poster, but saying written and performed by Declan Bennett, was I didn't realise that I needed that. I didn't realise that I even wanted that. And I've got the bug now. Like, it was amazing.
So I listen to a bunch of podcasts, and they'll always talk about, like, comedian Wolf and Owl podcast, that kind of. And they always talk about Edinburgh Fringe as that kind of melting pot of creativity. Yeah. And they'll often talk about when they first started, the slog they had to go through to get tickets sold, because obviously it's a big menu of things you can go to, and obviously with yours being a sellout, how did you do that? How did you encourage people to buy tickets?
It was a labor of love on a daily basis. I was out on the streets every single day, along with every other single person, giving out flyers and putting out posters and talking to people and connecting with people and going to see other people's shows. And I think the Edinburgh Fringe is a real, it is whatever you want it to be, basically. And, you know, if you want to be successful, and if you want people to see your show, you have to hustle. And hustling is not necessarily my forte. Like, I'll do it if I have to.
Just networking and stuff, honestly, it's stuff that does my head in as well.
It's so hard. And also because I hadn't been to the festival in such a long time, I don't think I was really prepared for what that side of it was going to feel like. But very, very quickly, the cool thing is like the venue where I was in Underbelly in Cowgate, you know, and there was probably 35 shows on just in that venue. There's over like 2,000 shows across the Edinburgh Fringe. So very, very quickly within the first few days, you know, I was sort of making sure I was sort of connected with the show that was on before me and the show that was after me. And it was amazing how quickly I started to build my own little Edinburgh Fringe community of people around me. And we just all supported each other. We went to see each other's shows, and I would take flyers from another show and I would put them on the seats of my theatre before my show started, and they would do the same. And yeah, it just sort of happened like that. It was about connecting with people and finding people on a similar wavelength and doing similar stuff that you're doing.
It's hard work, Declan. That's the key thing. I'm pleased because it's kind of pulled out what I wanted to out of that. The headline is Sell Out Run at Edinburgh Fringe. What people don't see is that work, that grind, that hard. And I think that's Coventry. Coventry gives us that, you know, that hard work, that fighting ethic of working hard. Things don't happen without kind of working hard to motivate it, I guess.
Totally. I mean, listen, I talk about Cob a lot in the show. Cob is a really important part of it for a multitude of reasons. But I agree with you. I think there's a hustle culture in Coventry, and particularly depending on your generation and when you grew up. And I was born in 1981. And so I grew up in Cob in the 80s and the 90s. But we didn't have a lot. It was a very working class city. And, you know, people... But there was a community, and people would support each other. There was quite a rough edge to Cobb as well. You know, the thing that I say in the show is like, you know, I was born in 1981, the year of the Coventry riots, and you know, I used to hear that Coventry was the second highest crime rated city in Europe, and I remember used to say that like it had harsh edges to it. But I think like you were talking about, I think when a place has harsh edges. And it is not the easiest place necessarily to survive and to make a living and to, you know, find your way in life, you know, and if you run with that, you can create really special things.
Yeah, I love it. There's people like Gus Khan, and then there's people. So I would imagine all of us. So I turn 40 in a couple of months. So I'm pretty similar. You've got Gus, you've got JD, you've got Corey from the Belgrade. You know, these people that have made things happen themselves. I'm sure every city has it, but I do see a trend coming through people that are creative in the city, which are like, we push through, that it wasn't easy, but we kind of wear Cobb as a bit of a badge of honor at the same time. There's a couple of people that I feel distance themselves away from the city, but then there's those that really go, do you know what, I'm Coventry, and that speaks for kind of who I am and what's driven me. And that's what I'd love to see from
you. Yeah, totally. Yeah, I can relate to that, Aaron. Like, there was, I won't lie, like, I wanted to get out of Cobb as soon as I possibly could. I struggled growing up in Cobb, and a lot of that had to do with my sexuality and the fact that when I realized that I was gay, and I was 13, 14 years old, you know, going to Catholic church, you know, going to school, growing up in the 90s when homophobia was rife. And I really struggled to sort of find my identity and to be the person that I wanted to be. And that had a really me deciding to go into the arts, because I found refuge in theatre. And that's where the Belgrade came in. You know, I joined the Belgrade Youth Theatre when I was 14, 15. And everybody that was there was a bit of a misfit. You know, everybody sort of, you know, they all had their own sort of thing where they were either being bullied or they were struggling. They were from a really difficult background, a different home. It was such an amazing mash of people who were struggling in their own little way. And we all found solace in that. And we all found joy by going to rehearsals a few times a week and putting these shows on. And then as I started to, you know, get into my late teens, and again, was sort of still struggling with the sexuality sort of stuff, I just knew at that point in the sort of the late 90s, I didn't feel like I was able to come out in Cov. I had to leave Cov in order to become the person that I needed to be. And that wasn't a choice to begin with, because I got into Point Break, and Point Break whisked me off into the dark realms of Top of the Pops and Smash Hits magazine interviews. That brought us some interesting stories with it. But what's really cool now, and this is why Boy Out the City and my show means so much to me, and it means so much to me doing it at the Bowery specifically, is because I am that person now, where now I can look back on the last sort of 30 years of my life and go, yeah, do you know what? Cov was hard and it was really difficult for me, and I talk about it very explicitly in the show. But I'm proud of Cov now, and I'm proud of me, and I'm proud of my relationship towards the city and how that's changed. And part of me bringing this story back home and back to Coventry is, one, so I can say to people, here, look, you might not have known this, but this is what was going on for me. Mm. And it was hard. And I feel like it's my duty to say, to put that back into Coventry and go, it wasn't easy. And then also to go, no matter what you've been through, no matter what's going through, this is my home. And it will always be my home, and it will always be where I'm from. And I feel like I'm finally making friends with it again. And doing the show and being back here is a part of that process.
Honestly, when I first started doing the Coventry stuff, I wrote a piece which was almost like, I released pin badges, again, it's a shame, but I released one which was like, it's a batch, and then sent to Coventry. So all things about city. And through that work has almost brought me a little bit of closure with the city as well. I always felt like disconnected from it. I went to university and I left the city as soon as I could. And I came back, and then I worked in corporate job, but over the last 6 or 7 years when I've been doing the more creative stuff, and it has brought me closer to city. Now, what I wonder is whether or not it comes with age, and whether the two of us being similar ages and actually being able to almost take a step away from your youth a little bit now and go, oh, actually, that's part of who you are, but it was a different time, and you're essentially a different person when you're in your teens, and even my early 20s feels like a different person to kind of who I am now. How have you found it revisiting that time? Has it been tough, or have you used it as a bit of therapy almost to come to peace with how things were at that time?
Yeah, I think it's definitely cathartic, it's definitely therapeutic. But here, listen, there's a version of Boy Out the City that could be really dark and really depressing and very exclusive, and that, you know, people could sit there for an hour and at the end of it go, all right, Jack, thanks for getting off your chest. Nice one. Whereas it was always my intention writing it was like, yeah, it was going to be a piece that needed to mean something to me and allow me to sort of to tie up a few loose ends with my history. But it needed to be universal. It needed to be inviting. And everybody needed to be able to find themselves within my story and within the journey that I go on, you know, in that show. So, yeah, whilst it has been therapeutic, it's been all of those things. This feels like the story that I've been trying to tell for the past 25 years, and I tried to tell it with music, and I tried to tell it with songs, and I tried to bring it to creative projects that I've worked on. And for whatever reason, that bloody lockdown, it just happened. And it just happened. It happened. Like some of the best things. Like I love it when like with you with the books and with the writing. And my favorite pieces of art are when they happen without you realizing that they're going to happen.
Yeah.
And they just seem to fall out. And it's like that you are blissfully unaware that this story needs to be told, and you didn't realize.
Have you had to adapt it in any way for a Coventry audience, or are you running with what you ran elsewhere? Is it something that you tweaked, or is any different?
We did all this tweaking at the beginning, because obviously it was all based in my journals, you know. So there was some things that I wrote in some of them journals where my director and co-creator Nancy, she was like, "Deck, if that person is going to see this show," she's like, "you got to get rid of that. Like, that's too much." So we did a lot of editing. And also there were moments where I thought, am I being a little bit harsh there with, you know, my sort of attitude and my relationship towards either people, specific people, or or the city itself. And that they were the definitive moments where I had to go, no, because actually I don't have that relationship with those people or with that city anymore. We're talking about when I was 7 and when I was 14 and when I was 18 and when I was 20. And that's why I'm able to tell that story now. I couldn't have told those stories when I was 20 or even 30. I wasn't ready to tell stories. I wasn't ready to sort of own that. And I feel like there's been a really healthy distance between, you know, a lot of the things that happened that I talk about in the show. I feel confident being able to do it now, which is class.
Not to spoil the show, but do you tell, when you're telling your story, are you telling it as if you were at that time, or are you telling it as if you're looking back on it and telling the story?
So the show goes, it sort of goes back and forth. So essentially, like I was talking about before, it's basically, you know, if you were to take me out of the equation, the story is essentially about a guy who finds himself completely alone and in solitude, during the pandemic, because his other half goes and lives in America for 6 months. And throughout that whole time, and that second lockdown got really heavy, and he starts maybe drinking a little bit too early, and then this sort of anxiety and these memories and these feelings start coming up, and he's sort of looking at himself in the mirror, and he's sort of almost like a bit of a haunting. And through those memories and through those stories that sort of keep developing inside of him, he starts to sort of go back in time to when he was 7 and when he was 14 and when he was 18, and there's a sort of a chronological order then. And then I'm not going to ruin the ending or the climax of the show, but then it starts to sort of take on a bit of a sort of out there, slightly weird meta situation. Like, it's not just me standing there being like, hello, my name's Declan. You know, I found it really hard being gay in Cosmos 15. Mm-hmm. It's not that. Like, it's a play. Like, it could be done by another actor. And it just happens to be about me, and it's very autobiographical. But like I said, listen, it's powerful, it's emotional, but it's funny. And it's got a wicked soundtrack, which I'm thrilled about.
When you were telling the story then, I noticed myself in the camera, like almost getting myself more and more invested, like I'm listening to a story, and then you were like, I'm not going to tell you anymore. I was like, oh no, I don't know what's happening. How was it juggling the darker side with the humour? I know we've kind of touched upon it, but go on, you tell me.
Do you know what, it wasn't, there was a lot of both, you know, and as I say, my director and co-creator Nancy Sullivan was such an integral part of that, and once we realized what the story was and we knew what the trajectory was and we knew what we wanted the show to be, once we started playing with it and put it on its feet, that was when we really started to play around with the dynamics of making theater. And I think the best theater is when you're taken to one place and then you're quickly snapped somewhere else. And the show does that a lot, in not just in its sort of jumping through periods of time, but in it will take you to a place where we'll be like, okay, we're getting dark now. Okay, this stuff is getting serious. And then you just drop a clanger in there that makes people laugh. And, you know, I think there's a lot of comedians will sort of talk about stuff like that. And it's, you know, you're setting people up, and that's sort of how you get people inside, how you sort of invite people in. I loved the whole process. It's just a completely brand new thing for me, and I don't know, I guess I realized it was a bit funnier than I thought it was.
Honestly, it sounds like extremely cool. I've got a load of questions here, but this is what I always do, fly around a little bit. I can ask the questions I want to ask.
What's the way?
How is it, with it being autobiographical, how is it being the person that performs it? Have you found it difficult to do, or do you separate yourself from the person that experienced it with the performer?
I think now I'm fine with it. But when it first began and I first did a couple of those scratch nights and I first started sharing this, that was really difficult and it was really hard.
Yeah,
because the one thing was that it was that I did them in London, so I knew that, you know, it was people who were sort of attached a little bit, but not really. It's a different place. It's a different city. It's a different history. All those sorts of things. And, you know, I didn't fight everyone. You know, it was a bit of an open thing. So, but having gone through that and then sort of found my confidence with it, and then the Edinburgh Festival was a huge deal for me, because I thought if it doesn't work and the show doesn't work in Edinburgh, then I know it doesn't work and then it's fine. So to have, and obviously Edinburgh is, you know, there's people from all over the world. So I would go out into the show, and this audience, just a sea of people, no idea who they are, like, and all age groups and different types of people. And the response that I got from people afterwards was everything that I needed to go. The show works and it's got legs, and it isn't isolating for anybody. If it doesn't matter if you're not from Cobb, it doesn't matter if you're not gay, it doesn't matter if you're not a man or a woman or whatever. It's a universal story about solitude and loneliness and redemption, and everybody, whoever they are, found something in that. And that's when I thought, great, now I can take it to Cop properly. Now we can go on the road.
Yeah, not to put the kind of seed of thought in your head, but do you feel a bit more nervous it being back in the city? No doubt you'll have friends and family from the city that will be there. Did it feel almost you exposing yourself even more than you already have?
Yeah, a little bit. Yeah, a little bit.
Sorry, let me talk about how you should be, but no, I can't do it. I just wondered
where. No. Listen, it's all good. It's all good things to think about. And I'd be lying if I said I hadn't been thinking about this part of it. Which is why the beginning of the tour was intentional. I wanted it to start in Coventry, because it's where I'm from and it's where so much of the show is set. And I wanted to do it in Oxfordshire, which is the second city, because that's where I live now. And I wanted to do it in Ireland, because that's where my roots are and it's where my other half is from. So the first part of the tour was completely intentional, doing it in those cities where the show is set. But Cov specifically, starting the tour off there, being back on stage in Palgrave, which I've been on that bus in the Palgrave since. Oh God, I don't even miss. It's been a while. I was probably 16. Yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah.
And so to be able to go back now with this and with this story feels. It feels. Yeah. I'm nervous. And I'm excited.
Imagine
it. I'm ready.
Yeah. Yeah, and I do a lot of work with my old secondary school, and it's been quite cathartic for me. In the same way you talked about kind of Belgrade and being back at Belgrade, almost I can imagine my face was the same as your face then, talking about going back to my old school. I do a lot of work with them now, and the thought of me opening my diary at the school and telling everybody about how I felt when I was young frightens me to death. Yeah. Obviously, you're a performer, you're used to this stuff.
What school did you go to?
I went to Bars Hill.
Just
down the road from the Alderweed, actually. And
just the bar, I knew a couple of people in Bars Hill.
Yeah, and it would be around a kind of similar time, but just I've got to say, it has been something for me that it's been about 5 years now that I've been doing it, but it has brought things full circle for me. And I do lots of talks now, I lead on their alumni work and all that type of stuff. And I imagine you're going to have that similar kind of feeling after the shows are done of, whoa, I've done that. You know, like it will almost, I can imagine not the sigh of relief of the show being done, but actually a feeling of accomplishment coming back to the city that you grew up in.
Yeah, definitely. And there's a couple of other sort of interesting potential things that are going to be happening now with the show. And I'm starting to work a little bit with the mental health departments in the NHS, because service on the show is about mental health as well. And so what's really cool about the show is that the show now has sort of taken its own life. But like with you sort of going back to school and you know, being part of the alumni and stuff like this, you know, my story is now sort of taking me into places, and, you know, whether it's bringing me home or it's taking me, you know, up north to do a big sort of talk in front of, you know, mental health doctors and nurses, and things again that I just could never have imagined would have happened. With this show, that I have to trust that the show is bigger than me now, and as sort of nervous and as emotional I'll be, and sort of relieved after that first night,
Love that. I know it's a strange way, but I'm sure you won't get many questions similar to that. But for me, I love understanding the reasons behind and the feeling behind of yours as a show, which is all about that and about kind of homecoming and coming to a peace with who you are and being able to talk about that proudly. I can really imagine how you've had that as a date in your diary that it's coming up and your homecoming. Back to it.
Oh, massively. And listen, there's a handful of people that that I don't speak to anymore, that you know, that I don't have in my life anymore from over the years, I would have loved to have sent a little Facebook message and been like, hey, you need to be at the Belgrade to see the show because there's some stuff that you need to hear. Here's a couple of free tickets.
Right, before I let you go, you've been so gracious with your time. My ma will curse me if I don't ask you about EastEnders. So you're going to have to just give me a quick headline of how you got involved, how it was like, and kind of that whole experience, because to have a cob kid on EastEnders was a big thing.
Yeah. Listen, EastEnders was not on my radar. And I had been living in New York. I got back from New York and I did a musical in the West End called Once. And
the Glenn Hansard film.
The Glenn Hansard film, yeah, exactly.
That was my wedding songs was Falling Slowly.
I mean, it's so beautiful. I loved it. And I'd seen the film. So I loved the film. And then when I heard they were writing a show about it and they were going to do a stage show, at first I was like, no, please don't turn it into a musical. it's so good. The film was so good. And then I heard that John Tiffany was directing it and the Wolf was writing it. That's like, it's going to be fast, but you couldn't have asked for a better creative team. So I absolutely love that show. For me, ticked every single box for me sort of personally and creatively when I was having the time of my life, and it was really successful and everyone was coming to see it and was reviewed really favorably. And then towards the end of that run, basically one of the producers of EastEnders at that time saw me in the show, and they called me in for a meeting and said, hey, listen, we want to bring this new character into the show. And, you know, at first I was like, please don't say sort of like, you know, his name's Bob and he's got a fruit and veg stall or whatever, because I'll probably run a mile. And then, but they were like, we want to bring this guy in called Charlie Cotton. He's Nick Cotton's son, he's Doc Cotton's grandson. And I was just like, listen, if I'm going to do EastEnders, I'm going to do it like that. I'm going to go in as that character. So I just got really excited because I thought that family is infamous. That's a legendary sort of bloodline in the history of EastEnders. So I jumped at the chance. I did the show for a year and a half, which was a really lovely amount of time to do it for. And then, you know, Charlie went back to Ireland. I think he's still in Ireland right now, living with his son Matthew. So listen, never say never, you know, if I get
you weren't killed off. You mean you've got that kind of opportunity to go back?
The opportunity is still there. Yeah, I think they had to, because obviously bless June Brown, you know, she passed away, and then they had to, you know, sort of have the send off for Doc Cotton. And Charlie had COVID. The reality of that is Declan was working in New York and could get out of his contract. So a little bit of inside information there. But yeah, listen, soaps particularly, like I've done a bit of TV and film, and it's a completely different beast to theatre. But soaps particularly, God, it is a beast. It's got its own thing going on. It's really hard.
Yeah, my cousin, they're going to name drop here, but I've been name dropping her for years now. My cousin is Lucy Pargeter, who plays Chad Dingle on Emmerdale. She's been doing that now for, must be 20 years that she's been playing that role.
Wow.
And you do take it, as soon as you've got Dingle or Cotton in your name, you become part of this legacy that is almost bigger than the part itself. You're going to be known as that forever.
Oh, mate, yeah, listen. And, you know, sometimes it's annoying because you do so many other things, like with your career, and, you know, and then you'll do an interview of something or whatever it is, and they'll leave with, like, EastEnders star, Declan Bennett. I'm like, guys, I did it for like a year and a half. Like,
Now then, just to take off EastEnders style.
I don't mind including it in the width of like everything else that I've done as well. But listen, I get it. I knew that signed up for that. But I will say, like, my God, those slow factors, it's hard work and they're working constantly. And the storylines are changing all the time. The scripts are changing all the time. But it was a massive, massive learning curve for me. Working with June Brown, working with John Altman as well. Like, yeah, it was a riot.
Well, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for your time. I'm really pleased we were able to have just a chat, as I hope we were going to be able to. I'm definitely going to try and come down next week and see. But I can't wait to see the reception and hopefully you to kind of go. I'm so pleased that I did that and experience your
Class. Thank you so much, man.